My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Everybody, welcome to the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I'm your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott Tilford.
Hello, Josh Brown, and hello, a season, a month of RPGs.
Oh my God, my
RPGs
friend.
RPGs are back, my friend.
We're absolutely flowing in them. I noticed before we started recording that on console anyway, yes. Not including early access, we've obviously got the launch of Starfield, which at the time this podcast goes up, will be in general release.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure.
That's a good point, actually, yeah.
We've got Starfield, we've got Baldur's Gate dropping on the PlayStation 5, at the end of this week as well. And then at the end of the month, we've got Phantom Liberty, which is the DLC for Cyberpunk 2077.
Yes.
And it's just a cool time to be a fan of RPGs, because there was a certain point, I thought they were going to go away. I thought they were dead. I thought publishers were moving away from them, because we saw the likes of EA kind of streamlining studios like BioWare to minimize the more hardcore nature of the genre and kind of pivot into live services. And then you get something like Baldur's Gate, which just says, no, we can make a hardcore RPG, and as long as it's good, people will flock to it in their droves, because it turns out role-playing in a video game is really fun.
We did an early version of this recording where my brain collapsed and I couldn't think what I was going to say, but I've remembered now and I've made notes to say it.
Come on.
Us talking about the state of the likes of Larian and Baldur's Gate and making super experimental RPGs, and it kind of ties in with when we brought up Mass Effect, and some previous week we were talking about how no one makes these games anymore, and all of a sudden now two of them come back.
Yeah.
And it made me think, you know, has EA, is there anyone who's ever been wrong twice like EA? Like, they once said single player games are dead.
Yeah.
Cue that massive wave of Sony first party stuff proving very much the opposite. And then now the idea that you're laying off all these people from BioWare, obviously they're struggling internally or whatever, and you can look at the past few years of what they've put out as to a potential reason why, but I don't believe for a second that was entirely BioWare's fault. And more you read into the likes of Mass Effect, Andromeda, and Anthem, there's a lot of EA entanglement in there.
Yeah.
That idea being that, you know, you need to streamline this game, you need to make an Anthem, make a loot system, make whatever, and then obviously people are leaving BioWare and etc. The likes of Baldur's Gate, the likes of Starfield prove that old audience was always there, and if you only believed in it and allowed the team to play to their specialities, you might have your own Baldur's Gate 3.
Yes.
Or your own Starfield, if only you believed EA.
I think, you know, you saying that EA's been wrong twice is like giving them too much credit. I think they've been wrong way more than twice.
Two major wrong.
Like you said, you know, they did the single player thing. They pivoted their RPG studios away from RPGs.
Yes.
They said things like, well, it wasn't them specifically, but in relation to Dead Space, they were like, horror doesn't sell. Mm. The whole industry was saying horror doesn't sell. And then immediately you get all of these indie horror games that sell like hotcakes. And they're like, all right, maybe we should remake Dead Space now. I feel like publishers, and I'm not the only one to say this, but publishers like to kind of force their narratives, right? That if they kind of think that if they say nobody wants RPGs enough time, it'll become the truth, but it never obviously is, because players want what they want, and what they want is good games.
It's not even like reinforced by like a game design thing. Like the two RPGs in specifically that we're mentioning, we're going to get to some specific talking points around Bethesda, Xbox, and Starfield itself. You know, this level of game is so complex. It's such an investment in terms of the development time to turn it around and everything, but it's not like the EA executives are speaking from that level to to say, oh my God, these games are too hard. We need to do something more simple. It is just more chasing trends, chasing the thing that they think everyone wants, and just saying things like that. No one wants single player stuff because we want to push you towards multiplayer and monetization and predatory stuff. And then, you know, horror doesn't work. It's like, well, you guys weren't making a horror game to talk about anyway.
Yeah.
And then pivot back around to Dead Space. It's been a weird decade for them. At the minute, for EA specifically, I feel like they're sort of calming down. You know, the EA original stuff. I mean, Immortals of Avium is bombing its ass off.
Yeah. But
at the same time,
it's a shame, right?
It is a shame. That game seems like it has some cool mechanics, and the shooting and stuff seems like it's pretty satisfying. But overall, this style of game is something that when I was playing through a bit of Starfield last night, there was one bit where I finished a mission off and the string section came in underneath and I went to walk back outside and it just gave me such a Skyrim vibe. And it reminded me of, obviously it was 2011 for Skyrim, but it reminded me of the 360 era. And all of a sudden there was like this wave of like, man, I remember when Xbox was great. Like,
right.
I remember that period when everyone had 360s. Obviously, you can go further back than them when we all had the Blades UI, when they rolled the avatars out. There's that dark period at the end of the 2000s where they didn't really release anything of any worth in the first party space. And obviously, Skyrim was always was Bethesda. But I feel like a lot of people played that on Xbox. And it just made me think of that kind of era. And it's a twinned conversation. Like, it is that state of Xbox and state of Bethesda thing. But at the same time, it's worth pointing that out. Like, we haven't had an Xbox game to champion at all. In a long, long time. We said that when we did the Starfield pod the other day, but it is a big win for Xbox, even if they bought their way to the top.
It is. Yeah, a lot of juicy details you've brought up there, Scott.
I'm a juicy
man. I want to go back to what you said about like RPGs and the kind of how long they take because of the scope of them. I think my favorite thing about the Starfield experience and by extension the Bethesda experience is that they're so grand in scope that no two people play them the same way. And I think what we're really lacking in games right now is that ability to share stories between each other. Like, you know, experience games and feel the need to jump online or jump on the phone to your friends or jump on WhatsApp or whatever it is to kind of...
I was going to say the phone.
Yeah.
I use a phone in decades.
I was just
phone my mom.
I'd have a landline. I'd even phone my mom. I won't phone a single person. I'd rather throw that phone
the
sea.
As long as we've known each other for about a decade now, I've never phoned you once.
I think I've phoned my girlfriend like twice in 10 years. I think I've done it more than
whatever,
that.
Whatever I've thought I've got, I'll text you it. It's easier, it's faster. No one wants a phone call.
I'm getting into voice notes though.
Oh, really?
It's like the ease of a phone call, but like without, you know, having to have someone on the other end.
I view that, if I ever try and do a voice note, it's such a tangent. But whenever I do a voice note, I'm too aware that it's like on a timer, like I've hit the button and it's like, right, okay, record it. And I sort of semi-rehearse it. And you'd think that I'd be able to, because I make a living off blabbing for all day long, but I cannot get a voice note right. And I'll redo it, I'll pronounce something better, I just can't get it right.
It took me ages, you know.
Yeah.
And you'd think, like, I very embarrassingly, like, I don't know, sort of shift into voiceover mode when I do it as well. And I just think that's embarrassing. I can't be doing the What Culture voice when I'm just, like, leaving a voice note for me dad. The point is, though, if there was indeed a point that Starfield, Bethesda, those games are so player-driven that, you know, the likes of even me and you, you know, we've played probably roughly about the same now, but our experiences are radically different. You have quests that I haven't seen. Mm. I've done things that you probably haven't seen. And then we can kind of share that knowledge. It's really cool to come into the office and talk about what we did last night in Starfield. And I think that's what makes RPGs of any kind, no matter the scope, interesting. Because even in something more linear, like the Mass Effect trilogy, you still have different ways to get through those missions, to experience that story, to customize who Shepard is. And that variation just makes this subgenre to me so magic and so special. And that's why I'm so pleased that it's come back, because I can't wait to do the same thing in Baldur's and I can't wait to do the same thing in Cyberpunk, because they're such rich worlds. And even in Starfield, which isn't necessarily is fully focused on role-playing a specific role or kind of, you know, altering the dialogue. The way that the exploration works means that you can literally go to 100 planets that I will never see until I'm 90 hours in, and that is just as integral to the overall experience than, you know, dialogue and builds and stuff.
I'd say what I want to focus in on is that idea of trust, like trusting the player. Like, I feel like over the years, I mentioned the wave of the first-party PlayStation stuff and the amount of, like, the opulence that comes with AAA games and the need almost on the design level or potentially the investment level to make sure the player sees everything. And there's always a thing about people don't finish games or whatever, but we are going to railroad you down a specific path with a certain viewpoint so that you see just how much money we threw at this thing. something and not take the risk of you not discovering the rest of it. That whole idea of how much do you trust the player to actually see or play the game the right way, I think has led to a lot of linearity. Or even in the open world space, making open world games that are still very linear. You're not exactly playing through them in the way that we are the likes of a Bethesda game or Baldur's Gate, where you can think your way through combat scenarios in a million different ways. A lot of open world games end up like Arkham City, where it's like that was one of my biggest problems with Arkham City, was that you ostensibly took another Arkham Asylum, if it was a plate, and just dropped it and shattered it everywhere. Mm. And all I'm doing is going to the next authored thing and the next authored thing and the next authored thing,
right,
instead of having an overall role-playing experience or an overall improvisational experience where the designer trusts the player to poke and prod around and figure it out as they go. I feel like, just to round it off, I feel like this year is a very important year for trusting the player again. Tears of the Kingdom does it massively, Baldur's Gate 3 does it, and now Starfield does it, where they're not holding your hand at all, but giving you enough tools to figure it out.
Absolutely. And you know what? I'm going to briefly
defend a lot here, Josh
Brown. Arkham there. No, you're making a lot of good points. I'm going to briefly defend Arkham because, while I agree it's not like the finest example of player agency, I like that at least in City and Night, Rocksteady still gave you a lot of surprises. Mm. And they rewarded you kind of sticking your nose in places that it might not have belonged, obviously the huge man-bat jump scare in Arkham Knight. Like, that's a cool surprise that you get from exploring. You know, some of the side quests in City and Knight as well, are disturbing and creepy, and kind of they just show up out of nowhere. Mm. And while, it is more railroaded, it's that element of surprise, and it's that element of, like you said, trusting the player to find this stuff, and more importantly, not minding if they miss it, that I love to see that returned. You know, we always talk about Red Dead Redemption 2.
I thought you might.
Hey! And how few people finish that game.
Yes.
I love that because it makes each individual player through more special. I found in the first hour a severed arm that led me to a crime scene. And I think that is something that you didn't get for a good few hours.
No.
But again, being able to come into the next day and saying, did you see that? What have you experienced? Mm. What part of the world have you been to? Share your knowledge with me. Mm-hmm. That is such a cool social element that you don't get in a lot of other sandboxes, and even a lot of live service games where the focus is, how do I min-max my way through the game? How do I get these stats up? How do I find the loot? RPGs, in my opinion, even though they might have loot and they might have stats, are about that kind of experience. They're about that moment-to-moment experiential gameplay that differs between people.
Well, I'll tell you what, I was going to mention Rockstar, and you were more positive on them than I would have been, because I think they walk that line. They are almost emblematic of the issue that I was getting at with open world stuff, where in Red Dead 2's case, and they started doing this in GTA 5, I guess a little bit in 4 as well, but there is a contrast between old school Rockstar, the original GTA 3D trilogy, and where they went, where when you come to mission design, it's go here, stand here, shoot this person with this gun from this angle, and if you step outside the area, immediately mission failed. And there's a really good Nakey Jakey video over on YouTube highlighting that stuff about the difference in the two, and how the thing I'm zeroing in on is the idea of open world mission design and quest design and world design, where it's expressly not telling you to go here, do this, do that. It's just, there's a feel about original GTAs that was so open-ended that a lot of, over the years, people have said, did Rockstar even realize what they had, where they were just telling you this target needs to be taken out and then trusting the player to either run them over, take them out with a sniper rifle, plant a bomb in their car and watch them blow up. All of the free-form exploration stuff that came from your side that made it an open-world genre, and then the break that then became, okay, how do we curate the open-world genre and give it the AAA feel and make sure everyone's seeing everything? And Red Dead is a weird example because it is free-form and you can find stuff that the person next to you didn't see, but main mission-wise, we're all doing them the same way. We're all shooting the people with the same guns in the same places.
Absolutely. I think, to me, that's part of the genius of Red Dead 2 because it manages to be authored and scripted while still giving you that sense of freedom and uniqueness in your character because, everyone's going to go through those main missions in the exact same way. I think in that Nakey Jakey video, he even describes it as you're playing a role. You're you are an actor being Arthur Morgan. You need to hit your beats and you can't deviate from whatever path Rockstar's given you. But in between those missions, I do think it's kind of a perfect open world game because everything else is almost freeform. All the side missions you will just stumble upon naturally. Yeah. It will reward you for exploring. But with Starfield, at least from the early goings that I'm at, that was a strange sentence, it feels like everything is freeform. It feels I have main missions that I can do, but the game is encouraging me at every step to, check this out. For all of last night, that I played it, which for like 4 or 5 hours, I didn't do a single side mission. I didn't do a single main mission. I was just randomly exploring Mars, literally one world and its moon, admittedly. Mm-hmm. And I just enjoyed it because, you know, there was nothing within the text itself saying, good job. You know, you've you've ticked this off the list. You've gotten
10 of these.
Yeah, you've gotten 500 XP for doing this mission. It was just all player driven. Mm. And then I came in this morning just as satisfied as I was the night before when I was just doing side mission after side mission.
That's the thing where it's just, like I said, to me, it's trusting the player, but it's also making sure that you know when it's okay to deviate and when it's okay to walk away and which bits you can poke and prod at. Like, I'm not going to do spoilers for Starfield missions, but there is a bank robbery mission that, like, as a setup is, like, very, very interesting. There's different ways you can do it and ways that you might think, oh, well, I wonder if I go around the side and do this instead. Can I do that? Yes, you can. And, like, I like the fact that it's not necessarily, you know, directly, like, rewarding that, but it's, like, the fact that you can poke and prod at a set of AI scripts and be like, okay, that's the guy taking the hostages. That's the negotiator. That's whatever. And do it in a custom order that, like, any other bigger dev, sorry, not so bigger, but any more regimented dev or whatever it is, would make it, okay, you talk to this guy, then you do this, and then the branching path is here, and then one of two things happens.
Yeah.
As opposed to the way that Bethesda do things, or it seems like Larian do in Baldur's Gate as well, is just you go through that in whatever order you want, and that beautiful falling down the stairs mentality,
yes,
you all arrive at the bottom anyway.
How do you feel, I think you've kind of already summed it up, how do you feel about so much in Starfield being kind of missable and kind of optional? Because is there a fear that you can kind of like miss chunks of the best content in the game because it's kind of hidden almost? Like, I did a mission the other night on Mars that started out so simple that I almost ignored it. It was literally find or mine 10 bits of iron.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
You know, if I was in another mindset on another night, I might have just thought, well, that's a boring mission. Mm-hmm. I won't do that.
That's precisely why I didn't do that.
Well, there you go. But locked behind that step one is a great multi-mission arc that was incredible and was the most memorable ones I've had. But I imagine, like yourself, a lot of people will just say, that's boring. I've got an entire universe to explore. I'm not going to do that for the potential hope that it's got something rewarding afterwards.
It's weird because I love it and respect it on Bethesda's part. I think they could do a better job at giving you like a more propulsive reason to explore at the very, very beginning. We talked about this on the other podcast, but I think the opening, nearly everyone's now saying this, like scouring the Reddits, looking at people's first impressions, as more people get access to the game, it's nearly all, it doesn't get good for about 5 hours,
yeah.
Which was the exact point where things clicked for me as well. And it sucks that you kind of have to accept that to a degree. It's not that there's nothing to love at all in the first 5 hours. And it's 5 hours as well. We're talking about 1.5 Lord of the Rings movies almost.
That's true, yeah.
So that's always my comparison for stuff. But yeah, it's one of those things where I ultimately do respect it. I try and think about the game more holistically. I don't want to see every last thing on my first playthrough. I do think of this as a new Skyrim. I want to go back to this for another 10 years or 20 years or the rest of my life and not see every single bit of it. So I think the only way to make it feel that grand is to make you feel like you're missing out on something.
Yeah.
And to make it so that the person you're talking to knows something you don't, which is the reality of living in this world. And I'd like that there.
Well, it's kind of like even moving away from conventional RPGs for a second. It's kind of why the original Dark Souls got so big, because its world was so obtuse and its lore was so obfuscated that, you know, the developers encouraged you to go online to discuss it, to kind of piece it together as a community rather than just like one grand canvas that you can totally decipher on one playthrough.
Definitely.
You know, and this is kind of a similar vibe where I'm sure I'll miss a bunch of stuff, I'm sure you'll miss a bunch of stuff, and at the end of the day when we have our finished save files, we'll be able to come in and then probably write lists about all of the stuff you miss and things that you need to go back and revisit to find.
Tips and tricks coming soon.
Absolutely,
my friend.
Yeah.
I think that the way that there's only the feel of a Bethesda game is so unique. And it's like, I think even they got, I would argue they got away from it in Fallout 4. And I know that's going to be a big discussion. We're going to do more stuff on that. Or it'll come up in different podcasts and things anyway. I really hated Fallout 4 because they tried to railroad you down a specific path, or it felt like they did.
Interesting.
I totally get pushing back against that, but I felt railroaded and I hated the dialogue system for what was even barely there, giving you all these prompts on sarcasm and everything else. I just didn't feel like I could get invested in it. It felt like it was always pulling away and going in a different direction and saying the wrong thing or whatever. Starfield feels like such a return to Skyrim and such a reminder of that completely open-ended nature where they have built a toy box or a sandbox for you to just I was going to swear the F around it and see what happens. And it's like, that was always the beauty of Bethesda. It wasn't about trying to curate us. It was about making a world and letting us loose in it.
Yes.
And it's like, I love that they kind of rediscovered that. And it's this feels more open than Fallout does. Fallout
4. Oh, yeah.
And that's the thing that I'm absolutely loving about it.
Ah, see, that's where I wouldn't completely disagree. You know, I really loved Fallout 4, like genuinely. Mm. I think I'm one of the probably biggest defenders of that game. Uh-huh. I thought it continued what Bethesda established, but it certainly did peel back some of the things I liked about that company. I thought the focus on base building, even if though it was, you know, mostly optional, was a misstep. I thought, like you said, the dialogue system wasn't great. It took a lot of choice out of the missions and how you can construct your character. Mm-hmm. I totally agree. However, honestly, although they have made some improvements, Starfield doesn't really remedy all of that for me personally. I still find the builds that you can make in terms of like the combat builds incredibly limiting. Mm. And even though I think I said this on the other podcast, while they have switched back to a mute protagonist, the options that I get still aren't that varied, don't allow me to go down many different avenues with conversations. And I was thinking about what they've done, how they've butchered my boy in terms of the perk system and the skill trees, because that feels like a big step backwards as well, where you don't get sometimes what I would view as essential perks until you've gotten quite considerably through the game. Like the fact that you can't, for instance, pickpocket straight away like you can in the Bethesda games, it's a small change.
I thought you could do the thief perk.
Well, that's what I mean. You need to get the perk.
Oh, yeah, you need to get the perk
before you can pickpocket. Stuff like that, you know. You need to get another perk before you can bribe someone. It's just a slow rollout, and it's kind of compartmentalizing, for me, the already limited amount of build variety and role-playing available. And I think it's not a deal-breaker, because at this point, that's kind of not even what I go to Bethesda for. I go to Bethesda for what you mentioned, to live in a world and to have this expanse to explore, rather than, it's more about the breadth than the depth in a way. But it's still a shame, because especially like when Baldur's is working so well, I kind of would have liked Starfield to be as big as it is, but also re-embrace those classical RPG elements.
It's so weird, because like in that specific, I wouldn't even have noticed that. I forgot that you can just pickpocket from the off, like from the jump in the other ones.
Yeah.
So I actually quite like that they've gated that, because then you're choosing to unlock that perk and choosing to roleplay and go down that way. I quite like that you start as a blanker slate in this and then choose how you want to mold yourself. And I think that forces you to build in a way that I guess you, it's weird that my starting dude in Fallout 4 could pickpocket.
Right.
Why would they be able to know how to do that?
Hey, you don't have to be good at it though. That's the thing. You can start as a pickpocket in Fallout 4, but you can be crap and you can fail every single time. To me, it's just like, like I said, it's a minor feature at the end of the day, but to me it's indicative of a bigger, not issue, but change in direction, because, you know, to me, pickpocketing is like the basic sort of mechanic when it comes to being a thief, right?
Yes.
And I'd want to see, ideally, them double down with other thief-based abilities to build on that rather than make what is kind of a boring mechanic anyway in the other games like a special unlock. I'd rather you start with that and then be able to really hone in on that style of play with other more interesting mechanics rather than taking things that were the norm in previous games and now saying, oh, that's an unlock. You kind of have to spec towards that. I don't know. It does feel a little bit limiting to me.
You definitely could start out, like you said, fumbling through it, getting it wrong, but sticking at it and getting experience anyway. I think that's how they did it in Skyrim. It was like, do it enough that you eventually break through. But yeah, the way that so far, the way that Starfield's approached me making a character has totally worked for me. It's not like I'm going in, like most, basically what I'm saying is when I want to tell a character to shut up or I'm sick of their S, I can. And when I want to be friendly with someone, I can. I've been able to call stuff out when I've wanted to. I had one thing not work, and I'll not do specifics because it's not a spoiler, but it's just the way a quest goes, where something involving one of these quests involved an amount of money, and I thought that amount of money would be reflected in dialogue later, and it just wasn't. Mm-hmm. And when I tried to do something that would force that reflection, the character didn't like what I was saying, and I was like, but before you were fine with this. And so that was a bit weird, but I was like, I guess because the earlier thing was a choice, and this is all really vague, the later dialogue was written in a way that didn't have to acknowledge that. So it's just it's always a thing where I always appreciate what they're building. I think that's another thing with Fallout 4 is that it just felt like too much of the same thing. Mm. Whereas like this, it is like unbelievable and monolithic what they've built.
Yeah.
Like I see the craftsmanship in a way that I didn't in Fallout 4.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Like Fallout 4 was definitely safe. Like I liked it, but it wasn't When Fallout 3 dropped, it genuinely changed my life. Like, it was incredible. I had never really experienced that kind of brand of post-apocalyptic fiction before. It made me seek out similar media of its kind, whereas Fallout 4 was, this is great, it's more of the same. Like, it was the building additions to me weren't that amazing, and the stuff they rolled back was disappointing, so I was like, ooh, I need you to make some changes in Fallout 5.
It is very, it's almost, this is a charged comparison, but it's the Mass Effect 3 to Mass Effect 2 of Fallouts.
That's brutal.
Where it's like, let's make one of these for a bigger audience. Let's smooth the edges, let's make it work for a bigger audience, and we'll give it the spoken protagonist, and we'll give you like easier dialogue options, and we'll have less permutations in terms of the ways that those quests can go, and we'll stick to our guns, and we'll just do more Fallout. And I think at the time, because of how long it took between those games, like between numbered Fallouts, it was like 7 years.
Yeah.
It really stood out. Whereas like in this, obviously it's like 8 years since Fallout 4. They just have this completely open-ended feel that feels like incredible just because of how big the whole sandbox you're playing around in is.
Yeah.
And it feels distinguished in that way. It's not like obviously it's a new IP, like, but it's just the size of it. They've never done a procedurally generated universe before.
No.
With actually like full cities and things like that.
I agree with what you said before about like, you know, appreciating the scope and how it stitched together way more, because, you know, I have my problems with the game and I think it probably comes across that I'm like making excuses for it almost, but that's like not the case at all. I don't think it's just that I appreciate what they have achieved so much that the other stuff almost doesn't matter, because what they have nailed works on such a high level for me that it's just, I couldn't imagine enjoying a game more in a lot of ways, because the scope is so big, because it imbues me with such a particular feeling that I haven't gotten since Skyrim.
Yeah,
since
that's my thing.
Fallout New Vegas or something, you know, and when I'm faced with literally the grandiosity of the universe, I don't mind that it's stitched together a little poorly or I have to sit through three loading screens. Would I prefer to not have them? Of course, but there's no other game where I would experience what Starfield is giving me in terms of a tone and an atmosphere and the quest that I'm getting, you know, with that as well. Obviously, No Man's Sky probably beats it in terms of space flight or
No Man's Sky doesn't have the authored stuff.
But yeah, it doesn't have the authored stuff. And ultimately, it's the authored stuff that's making me love the game so much.
For me, there's enough of the open-ended, I'm just lost in space vibe that then makes the authored stuff stand out even more. Again, we mentioned this on the other podcast, but you need the negative space for the solid stuff, the positivity stuff, to be registered and to make a grand city that you stumble upon or find on a random planet more worthwhile. No Man's Sky, they brought in more authored stuff over time, but it's nothing compared to how much is written for this.
Yeah.
And how many actual characters are here. I love Nada and Polo in No Man's Sky, which are these two kind of like alien beings that you find in one of the space stations. But again, it's nothing compared to this. Like, they're coming at it from different sides, even though they do have like overlap. But it's one of those things where like I said, it's a new IP. It's the first time they've tried something like new mechanically in terms of procedurally generating a universe and stuff. But it makes me look at it in the same way I did with Red Dead Redemption 2, where I'm like, only Bethesda can do this.
Yeah.
And I wonder what version of this we would have got if the Xbox acquisition didn't happen. I wonder, you know, would it be more buggy because they didn't have help with, if however much Xbox's engineers helped with this to get it over the finish line? Would it have been a buggier product if it was on PlayStation 5 as well? Would the budgetary side of it have changed?
Yeah.
Would they have cut something short? Like, Xbox need this in a way, in a huge way. But it just, like I said, it makes me look at something like Red Dead Redemption 2 as well and go, we're never going to get another one of them.
Right.
And it's funny because obviously we just recorded the news today about how Red Dead 3 is in development, which is hilarious. Go watch the video. But I just don't think you'll get that mix of authorship or authoredness and freeform exploration. I think somewhere along the way, some money man will come in and go, you can't do that. That's not safe.
It's interesting when you say, like, Xbox needed this, which they definitely did, by the way. You know, we've not been this excited. We've not talked this much about an Xbox exclusive. Maybe in the entirety of my tenure at this job, I don't think.
No, I honestly, like, to be completely brazen about it, if we're just going to talk about Xbox stuff, I don't think they've had a full-on people asking me whether they should buy a Xbox game since I don't even know when, like not the Xbox One generation.
No.
It's before then. Where you have to go back more than 10 years.
Nah, I agree.
I've always had the consoles. I've bought the Xbox One. I've been with them since the beginning of the original Xbox, but there is nothing in the last 10 plus years that compared with when Gears of War was dropping or when the first Fable was dropping. Or like Halo's run, like where that's what we're talking about. This is back up there.
Absolutely.
And they've bought their way there.
Yeah.
They've bought the, they've just gone like, just give it to us. Like this is an Xbox thing now. But it is up there.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Before we go any further, I want to talk to you about today's sponsor, Masterclass. With the amount of time we spend discussing and analyzing video games on this channel, it's always good to understand exactly how these experiences are put together. And fortunately for me, I can do just that with Masterclass. With Masterclass's streaming service, you can learn from the best to become your best, studying and growing with over 200 plus of the world's leading instructors. For me, I've been having a blast using a class on video game design by The Sims creator Will Wright to find out exactly how game mechanics are designed around player psychology, as well as learning how important playtesting is to shipping the titles that you and I both love. But it hasn't stopped there, as I've also been brushing up on my practical filmmaking skills directly from my favourite movie director, Martin Scorsese, as well as trying to get back in the cooking game with Roy Choi's amazing course on intuitive cooking. Seriously, my kitchen is a mess, but my belly has never been more grateful. For just $10 a month, an annual membership with Masterclass gets you unlimited access to courses on your phone, computer, smart TV, or even via audio-only modes. Even better, every new membership comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and 88% of members feel that the service has made a positive impact on their lives. And to put the cherry on top of that cake, right now, What Culture Gaming listeners get an additional 15% off any annual membership at masterclass.com/gaming. That's 15% off at masterclass.com/gaming. What's that? You want it one more time? Well, that's the URL, masterclass.com/gaming. Right, now I'm going to watch Tony Hawk try to teach me how to ollie properly. I'll see you all soon.
Hey, they always did that. Even back in the days Epic and Gears, that wasn't their thing necessarily.
That you're doing was, that like, thing for else. Halo for the Mac, or you know it's an Xbox game now.
Good at sometimes identifying like what works and what doesn't. But what I was going to say was, like, yes, Xbox needed this, but I also think Bethesda needed this. Like, obviously, I've been with them all the way through the company. I didn't doubt that this was going to be good because I really enjoyed Fallout 4. But after the disaster of 76, I think there were a lot of people rightly saying, and, you know, the sort of midness that some people thought of Fallout 4, I think a lot of people were like, well, we've got great RPGs now. We've got CD Projekt Red, who have just come up and defined themselves. Mm. And I'm talking pre-Cyberpunk here. In the glow of The Witcher 3, mm-hmm. which came out the same year as Fallout 4 and sort of just stole its thunder, didn't it? I think people were saying, well, you know, we've kind of moved on from Bethesda games. Like, we don't agree with this clunk. We won't put up these bugs at all. Mm. I feel like Starfield, you know, they needed it. If it was another mess, I think it would have taken them maybe 10 years to recover with an Elder Scrolls 6 or whatever. Mm. But thankfully, you know, I know there's been some backlash to the game. There's been more tepid reviews than maybe they were expecting. But playing it, it feels like a Bethesda game. And it's just like, it reminds you why you had such confidence in the first place. And it reminds you why you fell in love with Skyrim to begin with back then. In the same way that it kind of gives you more confidence in Xbox and their approach. Because it's like, finally, you have a game that's in the conversation, that's vying for a Game of the Year
contendership and is a reason why people want to buy Xboxes.
I tell you what as well, like speaking of the game of the year stuff, it's so easy when you're playing through a new game that is hitting you with all the new ideas, the new mechanics, the sheen, the level of production, whatever, to be like, oh my God, it's game of the year.
Yeah.
It's like, it's an easy thing to default to and we reconsider it later in the year or whatever. This has to be, and I guess we'll see how it feels across the rest of the game, the most impressive game that I've played this year. Tears of the Kingdom is the other one, I think, in terms of just the sheer, the game's matrix, the amount of different points that are all talking to each other in terms of the physics objects, how they stitch together, the different things that you can make, and the way that you then use them in the mission design, and it all talks to each other and it works and there's a harmony there. Starfield is less harmonious sometimes in terms of the glitches, the bugs, whatever it is, but it's just the scale of it, and it's one of those things where I was like, oh, okay, no one makes games like this anymore because they're really hard. Yeah. And we've got two of them, but they're both set over about 8-year dev times. Larian took forever. There was an early access version of Baldur's Gate 3. And then Starfield, we found the old post that Wokulture had in 2017 of when we first started covering it, when it was leaked on 4chan. But still, that's 6 years ago, and it was in progress back then anyway. These games are extremely hard to do, and yes, the fact that you've pulled one off does reinforce the fact that when I'm playing through Starfield, I'm like, this actually could be game of the year, yeah, because they're largely nailing a bar that no one is even attempting anymore.
Yeah.
Like, and there was one of the things, it's a weird feeling that I had when we were covering this, or the industry across the year, where it was like, oh my God, it's this incredible year for gaming. And I'm like, yeah, it is. The variety is great. We've got everything from Street Fighter 6 to Dead Space and little small games like Humanity and Viewfinder. But nothing, Viewfinder more so in terms of blowing me away, nothing at a certain budgetary level was doing anything new. Mm. And it was like, you're refining formula. Dead Space is great, but I know what it is. And like, this is one of those things where it's blowing me away in like a completely mechanical, gameplay first, player driven, you trust me to play this way.
Yeah.
And like, that's really special. And yeah, it's like, I almost given up that the industry could even do this anymore.
It's such a weird one, right? Because I think you could look at Starfield and kind of judge it as less than like the sum of its parts, mm, almost. You can look at the cutter, you can look at the mining and say, that's from No Man's Sky. You, yes, can look at the space travel and say, that's not as good as No Man's Sky.
There's
you can
a lot
look
of No Man's
at this
Sky,
and just say, it's Skyrim with a skin. You know, you can look at the invisible walls, which people are really obsessed with, by the way, that I've not
got
to do
to that
yet,
yeah,
by
yeah,
the
yeah
way, and be like, well, it's limiting, it's not as big as it seems. And I just think, I honestly think, like, not to, you know, just slag off anyone else's opinion, but I almost wonder if you're like, you're missing the forest for the trees,
yeah,
almost.
Yeah, yeah.
And I get it. There's a lot of trees that you might smash into on the way, but that forest is beautiful.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I feel lucky that I'm able to kind of see it in totality and be blown away by it.
There's something worth saying there about when you, it was like when in the run-up to No Man's Sky, there was so much mystery on how have they done this.
Yeah.
Because, and it was one of the most hypeable things about how have they built a galaxy. And obviously
Sean Murray.
Sean Murray was out there saying, like, look, we procedurally generated this entire universe and so many different planets, 60, 70,000 planets, etc. And that, the fact that we didn't know how they'd done it,
yeah,
and other game devs didn't know how they'd done it, that was one of the coolest things about it. There's something about when you finally present it to the public where they need to prove it. And I totally get it. Mm-hmm. I get the, like, it's like a scientifically minded thing. Like, you want to see the seams. Like, it's that thing where you look at a game and when does the rendered, like you said, a forest, when does the rendered forest become the skybox?
Yeah.
When it becomes the back texture. And it's like, okay, that's how they did it. Okay, cool. I can keep going now. And it's like, and Starfield's having its moment with that because,
yeah,
people have realized that the game's planets are made up of tiles and each tile is about the size of Skyrim and they all stitch together and you can see where they stitch. And I was like, I didn't need to know that. I appreciate it. I at some point, you're just telling me that Bethesda are still human. Like, that's
yeah,
that's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
I can still be in awe of the whole thing. But it is interesting because it's like, it's people need to chase that because it's so impressive.
Absolutely. And you know what? I think it is, you know, a thing that Bethesda games have already been lumped with. And I understand why people don't like past Bethesda games. Like, I can, yeah, understand why they get caught up in all of these issues and are just like, nah, that's ruining my experience. Because, you know, I could say that I think Skyrim is a magical game, but I can point at it and go, those bugs suck. The combat isn't for me. It's,
yes,
way too floaty. Like,
That
man's not got a gun. The way the dialogue is handed is not great. You know what I mean? Like, there's all of these things you can point to, but again, I don't think it's making excuses for Skyrim because, yes, it has its issues, but what it's going for and what it achieves on that grander scale has always been so impressive and, mm-hmm, so kind of pushing the medium forward, like you mentioned, and it offers something that no one else is doing or people might try to grasp and can't quite achieve that. Mm-hmm. I think that's where I kind of come down in it. Like, yes, of course it has problems, but
who else is doing this? Who else is delivering a kind of experience like this kind of right now?
Mm-hmm. And it's like I like almost get as specific about it as a specific feeling that games give, the best games give you, where you're completely lost in them and you're not thinking about the technical side of it. Mm. It's part of why I hate all the worrying about the different sliders and the graphics options. I just want to play the thing. I want to get lost in it. I want to have that feeling where I'm completely immersed in it. I want that symbiotic connection with whatever's on screen.
Yeah.
And it is getting lost in that. And there is something about it's like the magical feeling of it or whatever, where you're completely lost in a world and you're not thinking about, oh, well, that's where that tile ends. That's where the biome stops. Okay, I heard it click the next music track in because I walked over this boundary or whatever, and just living that life in that game. And like I said, so many games, especially in 2023, they're phenomenal, but we know what they are. We know, quote unquote, how they've been made. And I don't mean that you know how to code. I just mean you can see the parts, the character models, they're fighting each other. It's Street Fighter. Like, it's just one of those things where you, the amount of inner workings happening in Starfield,
yeah,
like that's what I can't even comprehend. How did that character keep track of that thing and then know where to go? How does this universe actually make sense? That's the really incredible stuff.
I get it, man. I totally do. I think, you know, I think to a certain extent, all video games are kind of performing a magic trick, right? Mm. And, you know,
the best ones are.
Whether they kind of pull that off and manage to convince you of the illusion will vary person to person. And Bethesda certainly drop a lot of cards when they're trying to perform this magic trick, but they managed to pull it off in a way for me where I'm like, fine, you know, it still works. Even if you might have dropped that ace of spades on the floor, I still believe in it. I still buy into it. I'm still fully on board with what you have to offer. That, like you said, when you kind of hit those hiccups that kind of maybe offer a roadblock to the barrier, it's like, no, because I still don't know how you did this. I still don't know how you've accomplished that. You're still providing me with enough magic within this experience that it kind of offsets the other stuff. Again, sounds like I'm making a lot of excuses.
My question to you,
if you would permit me to slightly move on,
of course,
is that what the hell is Bethesda going to do next? Because they have three franchises now, Scott Telford. They've got Starfield, they've got The Elder Scrolls, they've got Fallout.
Yeah.
And it's going to take like 5 or 6 years, if not longer, to keep making sequels to these games. And I don't think I can personally live in a world where I don't get another Starfield for 20 years or another Fallout for 15 years. It's just too long, and I want to maybe see other people dabble within these universes that they've kicked off. They're not.
Over the years, they've hardly ever given the IP to different people. Like, it's sort of like, obviously, Fallout New Vegas, Obsidian, Fallout Brotherhood of Steel, I forget what you call the devs that did that, the top-down, like, Melee one that also had some RPG elements and stuff in it.
I think, was that not?
It was someone known, yeah.
I think, yeah, who did that? That's going to haunt me.
Wait a minute, I'm just going to, literally on a podcast, Brotherhood of Steel, developers, excuse me while I, Interplay Entertainment.
Oh, it was them. It was published by them.
Yeah, developed and published by Interplay.
Yeah.
So,
that was
so still,
the console one, right? This is so messy now. That was when you tried to get like, the console market.
They'd all be scratching their heads wondering who developed Fallout Brotherhood of Steel anyway. but yeah, obviously Interplay, Black Isle, you've got all the sort of origins of Fallout. You've got the different ways that it was handled over the years and stuff. But I don't see Bethesda giving it to anyone else personally.
Right.
I think that it depends what they're going for. If they wanted to do a Fallout shooter where you play as a Brotherhood of Steel member, or you set something else in Starfield where maybe you play as, I forget what you call the dudes that worship the giant snake in Starfield, Vardur or whatever. If you play it as one of them or something, I feel like the weight and the majesty of Bethesda is in taking your time. They encapsulate the sentiment that Strauss Zelnick said, take two Strauss Zelnick, when he said the GTA is GTA because they take their time, and it's a big deal when a GTA drops, and you get one, now anyway, you get one every 10 years. And I think you do need to let the IP rest. In Bethesda's case, I feel like people know Bethesda more than they, or about the same as they know Elder Scrolls and Fallout, and it's like, oh my God, the new Bethesda thing. What I wonder what Bethesda's doing now, and I think that brings people in. And so I want them to just keep a hold of their stuff.
Yeah.
And I don't know what you would do. Like I said, I don't know what other genres you would do, unless you did it more like Gears Tactics and do something more like that.
Well, I guess, you know, and I'm not even necessarily saying that I want this, though I, of course, selfishly do, because I want more Fallout especially, but I was thinking like Obsidian with Fallout New Vegas, like give it to totally a similar studio, give it the same engine, and just produce like a spin-off or maybe even a big expansion. I know we're going to get expansions for Starfield anyway, but something within the framework that you've established already, a side story, just like give us a little bit of a taste. And I'm not saying like every 2 years or even every 3 or 4 years. I just mean if it's going to take 15 years to the next Starfield, if in 7 we get a spin-off by an Obsidian or someone adjacent or even a second Bethesda team, I wouldn't say no because it'll tide me over.
It's a really good point. I mean, obviously there's so much, I guess you would call it bad blood or just the way that it all went went down with Obsidian in New Vegas, and then internally they were denied a bonus and they were crunched and they turned the game around so, so fast. And obviously a lot of people love it, but the development was horrible.
I think they made it in like 18 months.
Yeah.
Something crazy.
Something
like
ludicrous.
That.
And that game did launch buggy AF. They just didn't have time to optimize it. And so I wonder how many of Obsidian's long form people are just like, we don't ever want to go anywhere near this again.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they are also owned by the same parent company as Bethesda. And some of the bigger veterans at Obsidian are now doing Outer Worlds and everything.
I was just about to say, I bet they're fuming. Like, they were bought before Bethesda, and the assumption was like, oh, now Microsoft has a team, now it has, with the resources now, to go toe-to-toe with Bethesda. Mm-hmm. Outer Worlds 2, absolutely buzzing for it. It's going to be a Skyrim, a Starfield competitor. Mm. And now Microsoft owns both, and they've got these two big space RPGs coming out. I know they're very different in terms of tone and presentation, but they're quite similar in terms of gameplay.
No, totally. I was going to say, to be fair, Outer Worlds is pretty much what a Obsidian DLC for Starfield would be anyway. Like,
true.
There are tonal changes, but there's enough serious stuff in Outer Worlds, enough decisions that you make that would... obviously, that's what they were aiming for anyway.
Yeah.
But it's very easy to forget about Outer Worlds in the shadow of Starfield because of how big Bethesda are. But yeah, in terms of what they do next, it's like, obviously, they've said that going to do Elder Scrolls, but it's just like, that's such a... I can't imagine how much fortitude it takes to get through a development cycle like this and to do them consecutively. Like Bruce Straley, after doing Uncharted 2, 3, Last of Us, and Uncharted 4, was like, I'm done.
Yeah.
From Naughty Dog, and was like, I am taking a sabbatical. I need a minute because we've done like four of these devs in a row, and all of that was about an 8-year period. But still, we're talking about almost 8-year dev cycles in a row for like 30 years now, and Todd Howard and Pete Hines, they've been around for a long time. And maybe that means that they just have so many systems in place that they can afford to restore their humanity enough.
Yeah,
but
I don't know
like how you go from a big project like this. It ships, you wait like a week.
Yeah.
Go, right, guys? Okay, next one. Let's go. Like, we've got another 8 years.
Literally, like when they were saying, Fallout, Elder Scrolls 6 is officially in production now, guys. And it's
just
like
the next day.
Amazing. Like, we've just got Starfield over the line. It's like, why did you announce this game 5 years ago? Why did you do this?
It's like one of those mining, or one of those things that you have in like a retail shop or like a construction site where it's like days from incident, and it just counts up, and it's like days since we started a game, and it just resets again, and it's got to go from the beginning again.
Question.
Yes.
I know I keep throwing questions your way.
I like System of a Down. Give me a question. They have a song called Question.
Question.
Yeah.
Question.
Good question.
I know we talk about this all the time. We've been talking about it literally since like Skyrim, if not before. I don't know when this engine actually...
I think I said, I don't know when this podcast started. It was 10 years ago.
I don't know when this podcast started, to be honest. What do they do going forward with the creation engine? Because that
kill it.
It's creaky.
Yeah.
Like you were saying there, though, these games take so long to develop. Do they have time to also postpone The Elder Scrolls 6 to create a whole new engine? Because that's going to take a lot of time. And you've heard so many horror stories about the team building the engine while building the game. That just seems like a nightmare in and of itself.
True.
I don't know what they do with that.
I mean, you look at Outer Worlds, like that is a very similar feeling game to a Bethesda game. And that is, I can't even think it is Obsidian who did that. I was trying to think if it was a spin-off or whatever. But that felt a lot like what a more polished Bethesda game would feel like. Still some holes in there, but the facial animation was better, and just the general movement, the shooting was way weightier. Yeah. I thought general movement was just a lot more satisfying. So I would just sack off the creation engine. They know, because they're in the warm bosom of Phil Spencer, that they have time.
Right.
And I think it's one of those things where he knows, Phil Spencer should know, and Xbox in a wider sense should know, that when Elder Scrolls 6 launches as an exclusive, it will make back whatever money you put into it.
Yeah.
And so it is better waiting, developing the new engine from scratch with all the money in the world, and then nailing the next Elder Scrolls and the next Fallout.
It's a good point. I mean, if you think of the amount of people who are buying Xboxes to play a Starfield, you can double that, if not triple it, for the Elder Scrolls, like one of the most anticipated games of all time at this point.
That's their GTA 6, and it's exclusive.
Exactly right. Yeah. So, yeah, take your time. And I know you've already taken a lot of time, but, you know, make that thing magnificent. Make that thing so watertight, it can't get a single 7 out of 10 in sight.
Slap IGN for it. I think, for me, like, Fallout 4 was the last time they could have used that stuff, and then they've done it again. And I remember when it was years ago, like I said, we've been covering this for 6 years in terms of Starfield, but it was mentioned that Starfield would have the creation engine again. And the wave of, oh my God, it's going to have the same feel that washed over me. And it does. It still does have the same kind of feel. I think in this case, because so much of it has been bug tested, so much more. I love Pete Hines himself saying that it's the most bug free Bethesda game.
Yeah.
It does feel like the most polished one they've done. It's a low bar in terms of technical polish. But still,
doesn't break the PlayStation. Yeah, exactly. Like
doesn't break the PlayStation console, and you can play it for longer than 20 minutes without it dying anyway.
Yeah.
Not unilaterally. Some people reporting that it is crashing for them. But
oh, great.
Still. Yeah. That's just one of those things where it's like, you just get rid of all those issues by getting rid of the creation thing. And I couldn't believe that they did their newest IP on the same engine. I get the budgetary side of it. And maybe that's the only way you get this game is by using an engine that you've had for more than 10 years, but
yeah,
still.
Yeah, it is interesting, I think, what you said earlier about them, you know, now obviously being a part of Microsoft. And what would this game have looked like if that acquisition didn't come through? Mm. Would they have tried to push it out for the previous release date, which was last year? Would it be more buggy, you know? Mm. I obviously, no one can answer that, but it does raise questions of like how much did they need this when they were more independent, when they were like really relying on Bethesda's next game, they were relying on Elder Scrolls, they were relying on Fallout to kind of, you know,
well, the thing
keep
is, like,
the money coming in. Now they're part of this conglomerate. Do they have more time? Is that just wishful thinking on my behalf? Will they be able to put more R&D into the engine? Will they be able to kind of shift course from the way they've been working? Do they even want to do that? They might not even want to. They might think it's been successful. I don't know. Like, all the time you're going to, you know, be brought to what ifs when we're talking about acquisitions of this scale, but it doesn't make them any less fascinating.
Well, the way that things are at the minute, if you watch, and I totally recommend Double Fine's documentary making Psychonauts 2, it's called Psycho Odyssey. In the bit in that documentary where they're like 2 or 3 years into development, everything's falling apart, and then they get bought out by Xbox. And the wave of relief that comes from just knowing they have the money to finish the project and the conversation, they're very fly on the wall for the conversations that happened there. And Matt Booty's in it. Obviously, he's Xbox's head guy, one of the Xbox head guys, and whatever. All those conversations are very open about, like, we're just going to give you money to be on Game Pass because the value is that you guys are on Game Pass. I firmly think that they are in the honeymoon phase of Game Pass at the minute. And even the other week, we reported on the prices going up.
Yeah.
That's going to change massively going forward. So at the minute, it's all step on board. You can make whatever you want. We'll fund it. Look at all this money we got. We just want new game. We want to be able to say that we have Double Fine's new game. We want to be able to say that we have Bethesda's new game. And we'll worry about the financials later. Where ultimately, they're still Microsoft. But Phil Spencer himself said they had to fight for the viability of the Xbox brand in 2014 because of how bad the Xbox One bombed. So for now, you just enjoy it. And I think that that means that the biggest, most endless dream games get greenlit and they'll figure it out in 5 years' time.
Good point. I guess, you know, knowing this industry and knowing how many developers have been acquired previously and then shut down. I mean, just look at what happened with Volition last week, you know, bought by Embracer, shut down pretty much unceremoniously overnight because a deal fell through. Like, what happens if a deal falls through with Microsoft and they say, we need to cut costs? They're looking at the gaming division. They're thinking, all those developers are an albatross around my neck. Sell them off. Cut them out.
Embracer is what the Game Pass acquisition spree could have been. Like, if it wasn't Microsoft at the very top. Yeah. It's clear. Like, if that was a different third party and that weird reality of the Embracer thing hinging on some billion-dollar deal to actually secure the money for the amount of things that they'd done fell through, and it all just went sideways. It was like, well, this was teetering anyway. But that's the thing. You make so many acquisitions and so many IP promises. It's really easy for them to go sideways if the actual foundations aren't there. At least the foundations are there with this thing. But I think it's Phil Spencer. I think he pretty much does to Bethesda what Sony did with Kojima. And it's just sort of like, we've got Hideo Kojima's next game. Do whatever you want.
Right, yeah.
For now. And then I think it'll get more restrained as we go forward.
I like you said, it's the honeymoon phase. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that, who was it? It was someone on Xbox who said, like, this is the starting gun for the exclusives going forwards. It does feel like that, and I just hope they don't squander the momentum. I hope the next exclusive that we get isn't another Redfall. I hope it's probably won't be another Starfield, but I hope this is an indication that the company is moving in the right direction and all the moves they've made over the past 10 years are actually coming to fruition and giving people reasons to buy Xboxes and good games to talk about on podcasts like this.
It's one of those things where, like, it's hot, like the whole idea of the starting pistol or whatever is the Xbox brand going forward. They've acquired so many different things. There are so many companies now, studios, that are under the Xbox banner that are now default Xbox first-party games.
Yeah.
And there's a level of, like, optics to that that doesn't really compute. Like Double Fine are an Xbox studio, but they're still Double Fine. It's still Tim Schafer.
Yeah.
He's just doing his own thing apart from his money comes from somewhere else now.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's interesting per studio, because Phil Spencer's whole thing was, we're not going to get that involved. That's why Redfall was allowed to be on fire, because we're not going to step in. But that was obviously the conversation, was maybe you should have.
Yes.
Because then it's not good enough to represent Game Pass.
You know, on top of that, I suppose we haven't really seen a sort of clean slate from these studios releasing games that were entirely developed after they were bought by Microsoft. Like you mentioned there, Psychonauts 2, like obviously dropped on Game Pass, but that also released on PlayStation. It was like a multi-platform game. You know, Starfield obviously is exclusive, but that was in development way before that acquisition happened. Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, it feels like we've already been waiting ages, but we're going to have to wait a little bit longer to see what these games look like.
I think Avowed is your first big one.
Yeah, I think Avowed, I think that's, even then though, was that in development before the acquisition? Did that come afterwards? Mm. Was the Outer Worlds 2 in development before? Like, you've got all of these games, all of these projects, video game development takes time. And in the grand scheme of things, the acquisitions that Microsoft made, they were all relatively recent.
That's true.
Obviously going to get Activision Blizzard on top of that, so it's going to be a while until see all Microsoft future, I think.
Yeah, I'll tell you what would have been the first major project that was greenlit after the acquisitions, or the amount of money put into the Xbox Series X, etc. It would be the Perfect Dark quadruple A game, and that thing is apparently roasting over an open fire. So who even knows what that thing is?
Well, think about, and correct me if I'm wrong, because it's been a while, but the next Hellblade game, I'm pretty sure that started in development before the Xbox acquisition. And it's like, I feel like I've been waiting for that game my entire life.
Well, Ninja Theory announced they were working on something else now. And I was like, you're supposed to ship the one you were doing before you do the next one. But I know that they've put so much money into the motion capture tech, which I don't know how much of that's going back and forward with being greenlit by Xbox, saying, okay, it's best to secure this motion capture tech, LA Noire style, we can use it in our other studios. I don't know how much internal sharing goes on between those studios, how much you're supposed to play nice with what used to be the competition, because now you're all serving the same master. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But like, you would think that if Ninja Theory perfect an LA Noire beating facial animation tech, they would give that to all the Xbox first party teams, or have access to it.
Yeah.
Because a weird comparison might be EA's approach to the whatever that engine was, that the Battlefield engine, Frostbite, that they forced BioWare to use for Anthem, and it killed it.
Yeah.
And it's just like, okay, not that, don't force it, but make sure they have assets available to them. I'm not saying that game development is a Lego plug and play, but it's but still, you might as well share those assets.
That's it. And like we're saying, not saying that Microsoft isn't doing this, but you saw how well that worked with Kojima Productions and Guerrilla Games when they were sharing
The Decima
engine. Yeah. They were getting like teams from Guerrilla who were used to that engine, you know, giving advice for Death Stranding. And
how fast was that turnaround?
It really helped the production. Like, that level of communication with the studios, difficult because you've got so many different moving parts, but kind of essential to get the most out of all of those games, I think. Visual Arts, PlayStation Visual Arts, that helped with the Naughty Dog stuff as well at one point?
I think so.
With like animations to make sure those games looked as good as possible. Mm-hmm. Having all of those studios at your disposal, it's like you get more resources, don't you? You get more knowledge, you get more experience. Yeah. These people know how to make good games, and sharing that, in theory, should make for really good products to come. But, you know, whether I'll be a young man when that happens, I don't know.
Your original Starfield protagonist, just an old man with a spindly tash.
Oh, well.
But at least we'll all still be here to see what the hell comes out of all these different deals. As a final thing, it's like, do you think has the generation finally started? Because they're saying a starting pistol for the beginning of Xbox. This is the most momentum and the most recommendation and the most conversation around Xbox positively that there's been in a long time.
Yeah, it's true.
And I'm still waiting, because I feel like you need that tandem rollout of stuff, because I get that Xbox has Starfield now, but then it's like, okay, what next? What's in 2024? What else have you guys announced? Like, they did do that gameplay showcase across the summer, but it was gameplay in as much as it's in-engine cutscenes. We didn't get to see any levels or anything.
Yeah.
And so it's like one of those things where Starfield represents a really great step forward, but I hope it's not an anomaly.
I mean, the generation started with a release called Returnal a few years ago. Best game of my life. I think Starfield, I don't think it's the starting pistol for the next generation, but I think this year is. They're not entirely fully optimized experiences, but with the likes of Resi 4 and Star Wars and now Starfield and going into Spider-Man, I think this is the year where people have reasons to buy the machines, whichever side you fall on, whether you're a PlayStation, whether you're Xbox. You've got Spider-Man on this side, you've got Starfield on this side, and you've got a bunch of next-gen exclusive games in between that are multi-platform to justify that experience now. Like if someone came to us and said, you know, what am I getting a next-gen machine for? Now I think we could point them in the direction. I could give you like 3 or 4 5-star experiences, in my opinion, of course, that you can play right now and you need a next-gen machine for.
That's true. I think I'm just thinking about the way forward in terms of like what the generation might map out as and what Game Pass represents versus Sony's first party, where it's like Sony's first party is all so similar. We've talked about the Sony formula a lot, same camera angle, same approach to game design, same overall feel, bow and arrow characters, left, right, and center. Sick of them, to be honest, and would take anything else. But on the Xbox side,
Far Cry 3.
That was 2012. That was Atreus broke me. But still, the Xbox side, if it all comes to fruition, you get 50 million, infinite Starfield type games in terms of the originality of the feel, where each thing, we're not getting an Xbox House style because Xbox House style represents complete total freedom.
Yeah.
And we have Double Fine next to Bethesda, next to Obsidian, etc. It's curious how that will go across the next few years because Sony are only tightening their belts. They're only tightening their approach, saying like, you will pay £200 for this portable system and we'll give you a certain type of game over and over again. In fact, we're going to remake Horizon because we're not going to put that money into anything else.
I think if I was playing the devil's advocate and more importantly, the PlayStation fanboy, I would say, yes, that freedom gets you Starfield, but that freedom also gets you Redfall. And it gets you a bunch of other, you get you Halo 5 and it gets you Halo Infinite at launch.
Yes.
So that's the devil's advocate argument, I would say, that at least Sony might be more quote-unquote boring, but certainly more consistent when it comes to the quality. With Xbox, we've had to wait 10 years for a Starfield, and hopefully it won't be another 10 years, but yeah, in theory, you'll have more of these more regularly, but I think the argument would be freedom also gives you the freedom to fail miserably.
Well, that's the thing. I would take, and I can't use Redfall as an example because that game was so mishandled internally in terms of what they were actually aiming for, but I would take 10 smoldering wreck flame piles that were attempting something over another Last of Us remake. That's where I would plant my feet.
I mean, I'll always take a Last of Us remake, but I also agree. You know, I'm also a fan of, like, 3-star games that are ambitious and do something new because they're memorable than the 4-star safe game that we play and enjoy, they never talk about.
Yeah, so. And as long as they're optimized and, you know, put forward in a way that does keep the quality high and you're not treating Game Pass as a dumping ground. I think all of these are the conversations that everyone's going to be having. Everyone's going to be having these conversations across the next few years because it'll be how does PlayStation Plus define itself versus Game Pass? Mm. How do the first party libraries define themselves? Starfield is a great step forward, but it's still Bethesda more than it's Xbox. It just helps that it reminds you of a time when Xbox was on top.
Yeah.
And maybe they can channel more of that going forward. For now, though, this has been the What Culture Gaming Podcast. I've been your host, Scott Tilford, joined by Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford.
Always a pleasure to play Starfield, and we'll catch you throughout the week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.